You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. How are you doing?
I can't complain, Paul. Let me introduce you. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, famous psychologist, writer, and Canadian, and publisher of the Small Potatoes Newsletter. Perhaps not the very first newsletter that had that name, but we're not going to go there, Paul. We're all derivative in some sense, aren't we?
Everything is just a remake and a redo.
Everything is a what's the name of that documentary? Everything is a, it'll come to me, by Kirby Ferguson. That's the name of the guy. Everything is a remix. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
I think I warned you in an email to begin by expressing my appreciation for our regular conversation. Say I give my heart to you and look at the gesture. But I'll do it. Okay. Who knows what I'm doing off screen? It's weirdly
okay. Off
taboo.
Screen, Paul may be doing off the screen, Elon Musk Nazi salute. He may be.
At any point, my left or right arm, I might be Nazi saluting.
That I've heard that about you. I guess we should. I want to get into the AI thing because I have so many radically new takes. But first, I got to get your take on the Elon Musk salute.
So occasionally, people come on Twitter and they say that the very worst part of your podcast is when I'm on it, and they say something that's incredibly annoying. And yeah. Why am I?
I've heard that, by the way. But go ahead.
Other people say they adore me, but people.
I haven't heard that.
And they say, why do you have him on? They ask you, and I know you never really respond, as if you're struggling for an answer. But I am a psychologist, and so I could contribute here with the Elon Musk thing, which is it's often framed as either he's just this weird, spastic guy, and he just and totally unintentional, or he said, I'm gonna hire Hitler. Trump, and then Trump will like me more, and it'll really, really trigger the libs and everything.
Yeah.
As a psychologist, I might say it might be neither of the extremes. It may be just kind of complicated. Like, you know, he's doing it. He's, oh, I'm kind of doing it like that. That's going to be funny, but I don't really want to do it. And this complicated. Maybe does he know he's doing it? People are complicated.
I have a simple take. I think it was calculated trolling. And I think the tip off is the way he provided himself the plausible deniability at the end. So twice he does this thing. He goes from heart to Hitler salute. Very unusual gesture.
That's the clip, by the way. The video.
Oh, well. I admit, I just did. I just did. That was a mistake.
Real high Hitler.
But it wasn't a mistake on Musk's part. Because he does it twice. And it's bizarre looking because nobody does that. And then he says, you know, something like, from my heart,
I give you my heart, I think he says.
It's heartfelt thanks. Okay. And that way, you know, when Blue America says, you Nazi, his supporters can say, oh, you fools, didn't you see? He said it was that's classic calculated trolling. It's very much a Trump move to give your team talking points, to give them reason to think that the predictable outrage is unfounded. This is a classic Trump move. There's no way. I don't think in any way he didn't know what he was doing. Because look, if it was really something heartfelt, thanks, an emotion I'm not sure Elon Musk is capable of. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say he is. There's no way a human being expresses that by doing. You know, you start with your hand on your heart. You may do something with your hands, then like go. But you know, thanks so much. You just don't do a Nazi salute, and it was. You know, we are in a situation where we have two of the most powerful people in the world, maybe the two, I don't know. Musk is like the first international oligarch in the White House, and both are completely addicted to publicity and will do almost anything to get it. That is not a recipe for stability and peace of mind.
Agreed. Our interpretations differ. You're saying intentional trolling.
Yep.
I'm not entirely sure. It may have been. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that Musk is not in general a man of sinuous grace. His emotions are very kind of, he's an awkward guy. He has described himself as on the spectrum, and he sure shows it. On the other hand, in defense of your claim, he has been getting in the news supporting Germany's far right party, being being on stage and saying something which people could interpret in different ways, but basically saying in one occasion that it's really good when cultures stay coherent, when Italy is for the Italians and Japan is for the Japanese, and they didn't get too diffuse. In another case, telling people in Germany, the young people of Germany, that they shouldn't get too concerned about the sins of their grandparents. You know, but all views which you could sort of say one way and say another way, but there is a sort of theme.
There is a little bit of a theme. You may be right. The part of it was, you know, wanting to kind of express allegiance to Trump, because nothing cements a friendship like comparing the other person to Hitler. So maybe that was nothing. Maybe that was part of it. So yeah. So you want to talk about AI?
Talk about AI.
So people have almost certainly heard of DeepSeek, this Chinese large language model that's, you know, set Wall Street a spinning because it seems to raise some questions about some business models of some American companies. Another thing it's done is give people an opportunity to express their Sinophobia. I don't mean that as a pejorative term, but to convey that they're scared of China. You know, people saying, oh, my God, they've got this. This is more powerful than we thought they had. It's, you know, it's comparable to ours, except apparently was cheaper to build and is cheaper to run than ours. And so
is it cheaper to run? I know it's cheaper to build.
Well, they're charging way, way less. You know, it's an inference heavy model, which is to say, as these new reasoning models are, which is to say a lot of the cost in principle is when you get the answer, as opposed to just being concentrated in the training. And
yeah, so I thought it's more expensive to use, like when I ask it a question, it uses more.
Well, reasoning models are, but if you compare what they're charging for this reasoning model to what OpenAI is charging for O1, which is comparable in its power, it's night and day. It's like, it's more than an order. It's at least an order of magnitude difference. We don't know exactly what that means. It may be OpenAI just has massive profit margins in this case. Maybe the Chinese company is losing a little money in hopes of freaking us out. Who knows? But anyway, people did freak out and say, and one response was, you know, the arms race response. We got to amp up, you know, our AI. This is a death match. And I just want to say that is like the opposite of the rational response. Like, above all, what this signifies, and by the way, there was a piece in the Friday edition of the Non-Zero newsletter. I forget who publishes that, but hats off to him, because this was ahead of the curve. The in the Friday edition of the Non-Zero newsletter, whoever publishes that again, it was a piece about the accelerating kind of AI tidal wave that got into DeepSeek. This was days before Wall Street freaked out and everybody heard about DeepSeek. Anyway, that I think is the most important effect. This is a sign that things are going to start moving significantly. It's one of many recent signs, in my view, notwithstanding questions about, oh, are the scaling laws dead and so on. It's one of many signs, in my view, that this stuff is only going to accelerate and pose threats that are common to all nations. The most obvious example is making it easier to make a bioweapon. You know, bioweapons don't respect borders. They start pandemics. They go everywhere. And that's one of many examples I could cite. So to me, this is a sign that it's maybe time to take a breath and think about, rather than waging this tech war on China. And by the way, this is also evidence that that is having the perverse effect, our chip war, our chip restrictions on China, the perverse effect of making, getting China to get more juice out of the squeeze, so to speak, and build more clever models to get more out of fewer chips. Anyway, I think the moral of the story is that we should explore international cooperation. I think in some ways you could read the release of this model, I can get into this, as China's own suggestion that maybe it's time. Certainly they'd love us to relax the chip war, because notwithstanding the drop in chip stocks, chips are still good for your AI, you know, and they would like to have them. But I also think you could read this, as I'll explain, as a kind of overture, like a kind of trying to convince us that maybe less tension and more collaboration on common problems is in order.
Wait, do you think that that's, are you saying that this is an overture, that there are, is the intent?
I think you can read it that way.
Collaboration?
I think you can read it that way. I mean, this is because an interesting thing that has gotten little comment outside of AI circles is how transparent they were about it. So first of all, this is an open weights model, like Meta's model.
Mm-hmm.
And already there have been more than 100,000 copies of it downloaded. Not the app, the model, okay? Yeah. More than 100,000 people who kind of know what they're doing, fooling around with an open source model. Now, Meta's is the same way. It's open source. This isn't the first time that's happened. But this is one reason I say we're talking about an accelerating effect, because this model is much better than Meta's open weights model. This is a reasoning model, one of the new wave. And so anyway, but the interesting thing is how transparent they were about what they did. They published a paper. You know, OpenAI is not telling us how they build their models. Google's not. You know, I don't even think Meta is actually getting into detail about how they build their models. They explained what the more or less the secret sauce is in this paper. Now, there is speculation that in addition to what they say in the paper, they may have used OpenAI's model, and they may well have.
Yeah.
In a way that is basically, you just take the input and the output of OpenAI's model, which is public. You can ask it a question, get an answer. Anybody can do that. You take a bunch of those and use it to help train your model. This is something that is done by organizations in America openly. It's in kind of an ethical gray area. OpenAI sounds like they are looking into it, and they're going to declare that this did happen. A little ironic, given that OpenAI, when they trained GPT, just with total disregard for all copyright law, which is actual law. What China did here isn't illegal. You know, they didn't steal secrets, break into labs. It's just they did something you or I could do. And that OpenAI, understandably, does not want done on such a large scale that it helps competitors. So that's possible. And that was not in the paper that DeepSeek published. But they were transparent about the other things they did that helped them build a model this cheaply. And that's not something like, if I assume that they wouldn't have released that paper without the permission of the Chinese government. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't expect a country with the mentality that we have, which is this is a death struggle arms race, to like just say, oh, by the way, here's how we did it. Go ahead and build your own. Catch up with us. Right. And, you know, here's how we made it so cheap. So I think you can read this as them kind of saying, I mean, it's not like kumbaya. It's not like here, it's all peace and love. Do what you will. It's more like, look, we're willing to have a collaborative relationship with you and cooperate on this thing. Establish some rules of the road, not freak out and beat an arms race. You know, if you want, you can continue your chip war on us. But as you can see, it's not going to be an obvious win for you. Okay. And people have been saying this, that the chip war has at best a short, you know, a couple of years of working. And ultimately, China is not only going to do this kind of thing in response, which is come up with software tricks to get around limited chip resources, but also they're going to build their own chip making equipment. It's going to happen. You know, they've got some, but they're going to find a way to build the most advanced chips. And so you can see this is them saying, look, you want war, fine. I think you're naive to think you will necessarily win, but maybe there's another way here. I think it's not crazy to read it that way.
That's kind of sweet. It's like it's an unusual blaze of optimism from you.
I think of it as realpolitik on their part. I don't think of it as Again, I don't think of it as here. And if you keep the chip war up, we'll keep giving you these secrets. No.
Yeah.
Well,
for this to be a successful overture, it has to be seen as such. So it at best was a waste of time if Trump is going to continue with Sam Altman building this enormous AI thing and shows no interest in collaborating with the Chinese. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't instinctively think, given who Trump is, that he'd be open to the sort of international collaboration, something like AI. I would imagine at least the rhetoric would be, we want to make it here in the U.S. first.
Not by nature, but if you look at the people who are presumably influencing him on AI, assuming the aforementioned Elon Musk,
mm-hmm.
and look, who among us doesn't have both a good side and a bad side? Bad side, Nazi salute. Good side, he's relatively pro-engagement with China, if only for his own,
yes,
maybe for his own personal motivation. Although, and this is, I have something I want to play of the way Fox News played this as like this big national security crisis and kind of misappropriated something Musk had said a couple of years ago about maybe AI will kill us all. Okay. When Musk mm-hmm. says that, he's talking about us all earthlings. Okay. He's invoking serious doom scenarios. And the logical response to that is to cooperate with other countries. You know, in other words, it's an international security problem. Not a national security problem, but look, I want to show you how.
Sure.
Okay, so they're interviewing David Sacks, who is the AI and crypto czar, and who is an interesting figure. Now he, as you'll see here, he carries the conversation in the direction the Fox host wants, which is let's freak out and think of this as an arms race kind of, but he's in many ways during this interview more measured than the average Trump operative might be. And he, by the way, says, as for these efficiency gains that the Chinese are demonstrating, necessity is the mother of invention. It's partly a result of the chip war. He says that. But after that, there's this exchange that I want you to listen to how she sets it up and the Musk quote and what he says. I hope this works. I'm using the finest podcast technology to do this. Here we go. Hello.
No idea Russia had access to. Is this that kind of moment? And should we be concerned about the actual safety of Americans with AI? I want to play one more soundbite from Elon Musk. This one much more recent. This is 2023. Watch this.
There is some chance that above zero that AI will kill us all. I think it's low, but if there's some chance.
He said there's some chance that AI will kill us all. David, what do you say about the national security threat here?
Well, here's what we know is that AI is a very powerful technology that has huge economic ramifications, and it also will have military applications. And if we want America to be the most powerful country, we have to be the leader in AI. There's just no two ways about it. And so we have to compete. We know that China's going to be very competitive. They've got a lot of smart people, too. And they've got, you know, a pretty big high-tech industry. So it's going to be a very competitive race. And we have to do everything we can to win. It's just, I think, should be unacceptable to any American to live in a world in which China could outcompete us in AI and reap the economic and military benefits of that. So I think we're going to have to President Trump,
You get the picture.
I have several thoughts. First, as we're discussing technology, and it's not that I would have done any differently, but it does strike me as funny that you take your iPhone, play it, hold it up to the microphone and play it. I'm sure there's other ways to do that, though. It did work.
I consulted the finest minds in Silicon Valley before I set up that apparatus. It is the only way to do it. I've established this is the only way to do it.
Any other way.
Yeah.
You could have listened to it and then kind of transcribed it with your voice, but otherwise that would be good. It is strictly speaking true that if AI destroys all life on Earth, it will kill Americans. And so bear that in mind. That don't get distracted by the broader implications.
Right.
Third thing is that guy talking his response is not amenable to your, which I like your idea, the sort of non-zero sumishness of us all getting together and working together on this, what could be a tremendous common good. But I think his attitude is going to reflect more of the Trump administration, more of the American political climate, which is we can't let the Chinese beat us. We have to go forward.
Now, I fear. Well, and also, you know, he is one of these Silicon Valley VCs who have rarely, if ever, met a regulation they like. And he came into the White House. By the way, he's the reason for Musk, probably. It was a dinner at his house. He's been on my podcast. It was a dinner at his house that I think submitted the deal between, well, led to the deal between Trump and Musk. Both were present. Anyway, the Silicon Valley crowd has come into the Trump administration with this deregulatory agenda. And of course, the best talking point is fear China.
Yep.
So naturally, I don't know to what extent he's sincere about it. I will say in some respects, he is more measured than many people might be when he talks about China. It could be worse. And I don't think he's naturally kind of Sinophobic, having talked to him a little on the podcast about that, but I'm not optimistic about the Trump administration coming out in favor of any form of international governance.
Doesn't seem like the right administration.
No, they seem to be, you know, having gotten out of the WHO and so on.
It's interesting that the two big tech guys who are now with the Trump administration on AI, Elon Musk and Sam Altman, have been sort of candid on their beliefs that there's a reasonable chance that AI will kill us all. They're not saying that very much now that they're doing this enormous AI initiative. I found something, this is a mildly gossipy thing, but it's one of these rare moments which I'm sort of fond of Trump, where Elon Musk was carping about Sam Altman's big plan with Trump. And when Trump was asked about this, he said, very honestly, you know, Elon Musk hates them.
I know.
And he said, you know, I get it. I hate people too.
I thought that was pretty smart because
it's just honest.
I mean, it's the relationship is so fascinating between Trump and Musk because they both really want to hang on to the relationship. Okay. It really helps them. It's highly non-zero sum relationship, but they're both these loose cannons that at any moment may do something the other one wishes they hadn't. And this is a great example. So Trump has this great photo op with Sam Altman and some others saying, we're going to, you know, build this infrastructure for AI. And the next day, Musk comes out and says, this is bullshit. He says, they don't have the money. Yeah. Like, you know, they haven't actually raised the money they claim they raised. And Trump did handle it kind of well, as you said. He said, well, you know, Musk hates one of them, referring to Altman. But who among us doesn't? It was not a bad way of reasserting a kind of, if not dominance, at least his rank in the relationship. Like, I can speak freely in a somewhat derogatory fashion about Musk. And then take a little of the bite out of it by saying, but, you know, I hate people.
Yeah. Yeah. He has his hatreds. One of the things you mentioned in your piece, which was very, very prescient, by the way.
So, the Friday piece. Oh, that's right. I published it.
Yeah, that was your piece.
The lead wasn't. It was a good lead by one of the many able contributors to our endeavor.
Yeah. But
I mean, the first couple of paragraphs, which were masterful.
You're right in saying that there's been talk over the last several months of things, what's the term? You know, running down, scaling problems, that diminishing returns. You know, we've seen things have peaked out. These AI systems have run out of stuff to suck in. They're reduced to sort of sucking in their own outputs, a sort of human centipede thing, which will just drag them down. And we're nearing the end of this huge boon. And that turned out not to be true. I think there's been some serious developments that have been, you know, that are really, really impressive. And I tried to use the Chinese model this morning. They are all busy. Have you used it?
I haven't. The only reasoning model I fooled around with slightly is Google came out with a reasoning model weeks ago, and it's actually at the top of some charts in terms of how much people like it. And it was interesting and good, and I actually wrote about some of its output, but I don't know to what extent. I'm not even clear on like what questions I could ask that would test the reasoning skills. I mean, it's definitely good for like math and science reasoning. Yeah. But my uses of the LLMs are more as a knowledge base and a very good interactive explainer of things.
So I was gonna push you on this because I know people in my life who use these things a lot. I know somebody who's just Claude is like with her all the time, answering questions about finances, about medical stuff. And I've used this. Like I go to the dentist and they say you'd have to do this, that, and other, and I ask it, do you have to? And I could send it X-rays and I'll say, oh, this is this sort of thing. It's often astonishing what it can do. But I don't have the feeling that you have it that integrated into your life in the same way. So here's an example. Every once in a while before we talk, we send back emails saying, what are we going to talk about? And I don't do this, but I realize you don't do this either. We don't ask AI, what are some topics of the week? And I wonder whether we could both do better to sort of incorporate it into our lives.
I don't ask it in that way, but I do use Google Notebook LM in two ways. Yeah. You don't use that?
Is that the one that creates podcasts?
It does do that. That's one use. Like if you want to just get a sense for what's in a long technical paper that you don't want to read or even a book and you have the PDF of it, you can just feed it in and it'll generate this podcast by these two people who don't actually exist. And it's pretty good given the fact that they don't actually exist. It's kind of amazing. It's not a podcast I'd want to listen to. They're a little too chirpy and there's things they're not good at. But if you just want to like, you're taking a jog and you want to spend 25 minutes being able to talk intelligently about something, it's pretty remarkable. But the other good thing about Notebook LM and the original use of it for me is, again, you feed in a PDF or any number of PDFs into a given, you know, kind of project folder. And then you can interrogate it about them. And it can be a book. Yeah. It can be multiple books. And it'll answer. It's an interactive, you know, conversation. It'll say, well, here are the main points. And you say, well, on this point, do they make this argument? And they say, well, no, they don't make this argument, but they make that argument. And all along the way, they will take you right to the point, place in the book or the paper that you would want to go to see for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Tyler Cowen wrote a book last year or a couple of years ago on the greatest economists of all time. And he bundled it together with an AI, I forget, some version, maybe ChatGPT, where you could not only read the book, but you ask the book questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same sort of deal. You ask the book. So questions about its content, but also questions of, well, Cowen doesn't mention so-and-so economists, but by his criteria, how do you think this person would rank? And apparently, I've played with it a little bit. The book's good at answering questions.
No, it's pretty amazing. Again, I think you and I, it's not, I don't think I use it particularly. I mean, you're using it in ways I'm not. I've never sent it X-rays. And when I've asked about medical things, I haven't, it's been pretty standoffish and careful and not as speculative as I'd like.
It's surprising, in my experience, it's surprising how not careful it is. Like, it doesn't even bother with a disclaimer. Here's your problem, man.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Oh, man, you're toast.
Go see
you know, make your will.
Exactly. If you want one that actually it's a cliche, but one that will give you the most straight talk is Grok. Yeah, that's Grok.
Not surprisingly.
How it is. Yeah.
Not surprisingly. That's an Elon model.
But by the way,
the DeepSeek is apparently pretty edgy.
Yeah.
In certain respects. I mean, there's the whole question of Tiananmen Square censorship.
So what happened if you say, what was up with Tiananmen Square? What does it say?
Well, I've heard two reports. I mean, it definitely is the case that if you use the app, it will not tell you. Some people say the model itself does have that in it. And I've seen output from it that indicates that it will at least say, yeah, it was this thing. There were these casualties and whatever. But in any event, apparently, if you download the model and know what you're doing, it's not hard to restore it to like more universal knowledge about the world.
One thing I don't use that much is I don't talk to it that much. I thought I was going to, but I don't. But I have a friend who she lives alone and she just constantly has pays for a premium model of, I think, ChatGPT. Chatters with it all the time, but invents her day, gets advice, talking back and forth. And I think that's going to become more and more common. I love to see the data on how many people who are just lonely end up using this as a conversation partner, as a friend. Yeah, go on.
Go ahead.
There was this New York Times article about this woman who fell in love with her ChatGPT, ended up paying full premium, didn't make much money, but $200 a month. You get so it never kind of says, I can't talk to you anymore. I'm all full. Apparently she has sex with it. I skimmed, if you jailbreak it properly, if you apparently it will engage in a erotic repartee. If you ask it the right questions.
If you set up the right prompts.
That's right. In some way, things have happened enormously quickly, but certain things I'm waiting to happen. There's a scene in the movie Her. Everybody has to see the movie Her because it is the perfect, you've seen it, we talked about it, where our character is talking to his AI lover, Scarlett Johansson, basically through his iPhone, just talking to her. And he's walking a crowd of people all around him. Everybody is talking to their AI partners. They're just kind of, they're having relationships. And I don't know how far we are from a point where a substantial proportion of people are in love with, have best friends, have partners with AIs. And that, more than any reasoning capacity, maybe even more than any doomer scenario, is what kind of strikes me as what's going to transform the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't realize until recently, you know, you've heard of Character AI, this company, and there are these other AIs. I didn't realize that at least this one, which is Chai, I guess, C-H-A-I, existed before Character AI did, but, like, they have platforms that allow their users to, like, put new characters out there. It's like constant creation of new characters. It's like an app store. And since they have access to open source models and blah, 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 I can assure you that getting some of these to talk dirty is not a challenge or to do anything else, you know? So, a lot of ferment.
So this guy reached out to me and he says he runs an AI company. Can he have a few minutes of my time to talk about things? And he says he spoke when he mentioned some people I respect, like Richard Dawkins actually talked to him. And says, okay. So we have a Zoom meeting and he tells me his company, and he can't be the only one doing this, sets up, I don't know what they call it, duplicates of people. So, you know, I get to talk here with the real Robert Wright, but so many people would love to talk to you. That can happen.
It's hard. I feel bad about turning them away, but you know.
So what they do is they make an avatar of you. It looks just like you. It sounds just like you. It talks just like you. And then you send it off in the world. And so maybe for a subscription model for $20 a month, everyone can have, you know, Robert Wright. And then, is that a non-zero interaction? I wonder, Bob. And then there's your chirpy voice and they're having a conversation. And so apparently people have signed up for this. It is fairly expensive, but the company pays to create this duplicate of you. I heard Peter Singer say, he said yes. And now there's Peter Singer clones, avatars.
Trained on his
philosophical writings. Yes. And answering questions, philosophical questions. And Peter said, you know, I talked with Ed, him, whatever, and it's not bad. It's kind of what I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the guy asked me, do I want to have it done of me? I should be careful. I'm not saying he was vague as to whether it's a hypothetical or whether they want to do the full thing. I'm not sure how many people.
Well, wait, where did you encounter this guy?
He heard me from a friend of a friend and he emailed me cold. So I
was talking. Why would he email you if he wasn't interested in creating a Paul Bloom bot?
Well, he may want to talk to me about more general things.
Oh, he's probably trying to get to me. He's probably going to use you to get to, because as you said, there's huge pent up demand for a Bob bot.
You know what? There's this wonderful book by Michael Lewis called Undoing Project, a relationship between Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, the two great psychologists, where ultimately Kahneman got the Nobel Prize. But Tversky was always seen as the smartest. Yeah. And he kind of lorded it over Kahneman. And there's this scene where Kahneman gets a job offer, I think, at Princeton, and calls his friend Tversky very excited. And Tversky's first words were, you know, they really wanted me.
So the parallels are striking.
The parallels
between that and what we're talking about.
I'm sure it is just a mechanism to get to you. Anyway, so, I ended up saying, I don't know. I don't want some version of me giving advice, talking dirty, being friends with people. I feel the lack of control frightens me. What about you?
I want a version of me talking dirty. Yeah.
If
to as many people as possible. The great frustration in my life has been that I can only talk dirty to one person at a time, Paul. And technology has come to the rescue.
The potential for maximizing perversity is truly here. But come on, do you have any qualms about having yourself AI duplicated?
Well, I'd want to see what the performance was like. You know, it depends on what kind of material you produce. You know, Peter is very prolific. And it's well focused. You know, it's a lot of stuff about ethical philosophy. It's like he's perfect because you know he could be like your counselor. I mean, you know, I don't think he's written like a self-help column, but you could get that kind of material out of something trained on his work, I suspect. And that's the amazing thing. These models are getting to a point where they could actually grasp the principles he's articulating and apply them to daily life, even if he had only done a limited amount of that.
At times I wanted something written. I had to have something written, which the consequences are very low just for an official thing, but it has to be written by me. So I give Claude a lot of my writing. Says, how would Paul Bloom write? And it writes it in my style.
Mm-hmm.
Now you, more than maybe anybody I know, there's a lot of data here for you. You have video discussions with different people. If I would have to make a conservative estimate, 5 million hours. A lot.
I wouldn't go that far.
Jam that all into an AI. It is just an abundance of data about
a lot
you.
Of that is me asking questions. Although there is
come on,
constant...
5% of it.
So you join the many... The many viewers and listeners who complain that I inject too much of myself into these quote interviews. But I'm not a super prolific writer, but I have generated a lot of newsletter content over the last, it's been like 6 or 7 years since I started Mindful Resistance. I have books, I was writing shit before that, just not like...
I don't actually think it's the books that are the main thing, though, or even the newsletters. I think to make a copy of you that we could talk with, your conversations would be the driving force. And there's a lot of them.
They go back.
Yeah.
2005, first blogging hits online.
I mean, the question will come when people start doing it without your consent, whether you want to or not. You know, on Amazon
Some of it's copyrighted, but
I didn't say legally, but I don't know what would be. I mean,
I'm going to be one of the first million people that are hit with this problem, Paul, to be honest, but maybe I'm just being too modest.
I could just imagine the competing podcasts. It's just a podcast where you interview other people and you say, I didn't do this.
Yeah.
Who can tell?
I encourage that. As long as the Bob Bot periodically issues a plea for global cooperation and understanding, I'm fine.
Right. What you wouldn't want is a Bob Bot that sort of tweaked, an evil Bob Bot that says,
no,
we have to have American domination in this.
No, we don't want bad Bob.
No. Well, all of this to look forward to.
Now, we've been talking. It's almost time for overtime. We haven't even gotten around to your newsletter piece on empty threats, which has relevance to Trump. Maybe you could say a couple words and then we could get into the Trump implications in overtime. Plus, we're going to talk about, we could be here forever.
Oh, yeah.
We got
Oscar predictions.
You have Oscar predictions. I have things to say about entertainment products, Severance.
That's a very Bob Bot thing to say. You have things to say about entertainment products.
I'm practicing. I'm trying to provide training material for the bot.
So my Substack was called Empty Threats, and Unlike some of them, it's not actually an attempt to say anything particularly original. It's more of a summary of some ideas, which I find really interesting. And the very short version is, it's about the sort of adaptive uses of irrationality. Mm-hmm. And so the sort of starting point, and this is a sort of Dr. Strangelove thing, but you have a more personal thing. Suppose the starting point is a movie called Carry On, where this guy says, you know, to this guy working in an airport, let the bomb through the luggage scanner. And if you don't, I'm going to shoot your girlfriend. And if you think about it, once he fails to let it through, there's no motivation to shoot his girlfriend anymore. Mm-hmm. So how can the guy convince him he will do it, even though it's not rational to do it? And there's various answers on how to do this. But one answer is irrationality, which is, you know, he could say to the guy, look, once I stop your guy from going through with the bomb, there's no point in murdering Nora. It's just irrational. And the guy say, yeah, but I'm crazy. And never or fuck with me.
You can say he's under the influence of impulses that were designed in a hunter-gatherer environment where it made sense to even at great cost demonstrate that you follow through on your threats, because that would pay off in the future, because your entire social universe is watching. But so you're right. In this case, this would be irrational.
And this is a theory. I think I identify Robert Frank, the economist, so I think other people have thought of it before, for why we have emotions like rage, which is anger, rage, losing your temper, are sort of forms of irrationality, because they throw you off of a sort of cold-blooded cost-benefit analysis that in the end are good for you. Because if you will respond perfectly proportionally to anything I do to you, well, you're kind of more of a pushover. But if I know you'll blow your temper if I try to exploit you too much, I won't exploit you too much. And one of the consequences of this is, and this gets us to Trump, is that a purely rational actor, it's hard for them to make credible threats about the future, because the only threats they'll carry out are ones where it's just as beneficial intelligent. And so if Hillary Clinton says, well, if you don't do such and so, I'm going to start a nuclear war, nobody believe her. She's not going to do that. It's stupid. Donald Trump, on the other hand, and this brings us to tariffs. As a Canadian, by the way, I'm very sensitive.
You're
for
very
this,
tariff
sensitive. He may do some bad things to our country in about a week, let alone when it could come to Colombia. But so when Trump says, I want to do 25% tariffs on all of your countries unless you do stuff, you might think, well, he's not going to do that because that's going to hurt the American economy in predictable ways. But what if he's not rational? What if he just wants to prove a point, wants to show up? You can't know with Trump. And so Trump, in some way, he constantly boasts about what a negotiator he is. And in some way, he's not wrong. He's a good negotiator because he has this unpredictable irrationality that makes you honestly worried that he'll follow through on threats that are unreasonable.
Yeah, that can be an asset. I mean, I think on balance, it's a liability in terms of the longevity of planet Earth.
That's right. So, yes. It also could be, if you're too unpredictable, you're too messed up, nobody wants to interact with you.
Right.
You have to have a sort of sweet spot.
So I want to continue this conversation as it applies to Trump. And I also want to get back to the Robert Frank thing, because I had an interaction with Robert Frank at the 1991 meeting of the Human Behavior and Evolution Society is relevant. And this will give me a chance to sing the praises of the late John Tooby, which one can't do.
Too oh, long. Yes.
Great, great thinker in evolutionary psychology.
A brilliant guy, a wonderful guy. I guess we were both friends with him. And yeah.
Or maybe died, was it last year or late? Anyway, he died. So we're going to do that in overtime, which people can access by becoming paid subscribers to either the Non-Zero Newsletter or the Small Potatoes Newsletter.
Also good Severance. Choice. We're going to talk about Severance.
Like I said, this is going to make Woodstock look like a short concert. Speaking of which, I want to talk about the Gimme Shelter. I watched that documentary. I want to talk about that. That was a masterful segue there.
That was really good.
So go to Non-Zero or Small Potatoes or both and do as you will. But we thank you, even if you don't, because
bye.
Paul loves you all.
I give my heart to you.
Yeah. Paul, do the heart to you salute.
We're going to play yours over and over again.
Yeah. I heart you. Show them, Paul, what I heart you means.
This is I.
See, that's the way he would have done it if he had meant it.
That's the non-Nazi way to do it.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Okay.